Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. My name is Jason Lewis, and you're listening to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I want to thank you for joining us today for the show that is shaping the way that the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Before we introduce today's guest, I want to be sure that we thank our sponsor, OneCause. OneCause is the leader in online, mobile, and virtual fundraising software. OneCause supports over 6,000 nonprofits to reach more and raise more with innovative solutions. You can visit their virtual fundraising resource center at www.onecause.com. I would also like to tell you about Responsive's 12-month recovery plan that we've been collaborating on for the last several weeks with several of our most trusted colleagues in the fundraising space. We are very grateful to Jennifer Harris, Andrew Olson, Teresa Lee, as well as our friends at OneCause and iWave for contributing to this plan. This resource is available to you for free. All you have to do is go to our website at www.responsivefundraising.com/recovery plan and download it. I will also be sure to include a link in the show notes. Now let's introduce today's guest. Hi, Carlene. Delighted to have you back on the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I don't think that the first time we recorded, it actually made it to the broadcast, because I think I was botching things up that first 10 or 12 broadcasts. But I'm delighted to have you back. We're going to catch up here in the midst of COVID-19. I'm delighted to hear sort of what's going on in your world and how all of this has played out for you. Before we do that, why don't you just introduce yourself to our listeners?
Sure. And Jason, thank you so much for having me today. I'm Carlene Jennings. I am Executive Director of Advancement and External Relations for the UNC Greensboro Libraries. And it's a pleasure to be here. I also serve as the incoming chair for the American Library Association Philanthropic Advisory Group. So it's nice to be wearing multiple hats on your podcast today.
Yeah, Carlene, so the first time we talked, I remember we talked about libraries then, and I don't remember, that was 2 years ago, but what does it mean to be a library in the midst of this, in a pandemic? I can't even imagine what the library world is probably thinking about. I mean, everything's gone virtual. You can't check out books. What does it mean in your world? What is that world talking about?
Well, and I think that's one of the key things that the world is talking about, because not every library is the same. There were some that have never closed throughout the pandemic around the country, whether they're academic or public. There are some that have been offering curbside pickup all along. Transitioning classes, for example, in the higher ed space to all online was a major undertaking for many. How are they making their collections accessible? How are we sharing resources across institutions? All of those things. And then how is it going to change study space? How is it going to change academic partnerships? Those are all concepts in my area, which is academic libraries. But even in the public library space, one of the key things that's come out of this is, how do you define essential? How do you define what an essential service is? And does essential mean how it's been used in terms of the pandemic is physically accessible? So, for example, staff and others who are deemed essential workers must go into a physical space. But I would counter that with, there's a lot of essential services that we have now moved to a strictly online environment.
It's interesting that you asked that question, because we've been talking about that, my wife and I, locally with our older children, about what's essential here in our local community. And they know that their dad, I'm working on a book,
And right now, the only way I can get access, or I thought I could get access, I would not have thought that my local library maybe had curbside service, but the only way I feel like I can get books for the last eight to 10 weeks has been Amazon. And so it's kind of fascinating to hear you say that the library world is sort of asking that question. Because for somebody who writes and speaks and usually tries to have really smart things to say, books are pretty essential for a guy like me.
Well, and then I think it's also this whole concept of open access publishing that we're dealing with as well, of what is accessible, what, because of copyright, can be scanned, cannot be scanned, can be made accessible through a library. And I say that one of the other key things that's come up in library circles related to this is about broadband access. You know, there are libraries that they closed their doors, but they kept their Wi-Fi on so students could use that and users could access materials that way. And so, you know, libraries are in a state of major transition. You know, we've gone through many different iterations over time. When you think about, you know, cataloging before the internet or before digitized collections or before, you know, you had to go and physically look up in the catalog to go find the book, to go find the journal. It's changed a lot. And even just how we think about our space and what our needs are from a national standpoint, it's really changed quite significantly. It's not just about the physical space, it's about the intellectual space. And, you know, when you, to use a different example, there's been a lot of discussion in the country about churches and are churches open right now? Yes,
yeah,
they are.
Right, sure. Yeah.
And the physical building might not be open, but they're still offering their resources and they're still accessible to their community. And that's the same thing with libraries.
So Carlene, before you and I hit the record button, and I don't want to put any words in your mouth, but I like to let my guest sort of guide the conversation. You and I were sort of comparing and contrasting your journey for the last 8 to 10 weeks and my journey for the last 8 to 10 weeks. And so let's just sort of follow your lead. What has sort of this last 90 days sort of been for you? And what sort of things have you learned about yourself, about your world, about your work? What has been the silver lining and where do you think this is, where do you think this is going? So I just put a lot on the table and you can take it anywhere you'd like to.
Well, and you know, one of the things that I've been, I live alone. So I travel so much that I don't even have a pet. So the closest thing I have to a pet is a peace lily that's named Ned. And I say that because, you know, I last year I traveled 120 days.
Yeah.
So yeah. You've taken an extrovert and put her in her house for this amount of time. And I've come up with some creative projects. I've repainted porch furniture and created.
You've painted everything that could possibly be painted, right?
I have. I've even created window treatments and other things like that. And I'm also a sports nut. So you've put me in my house with no sports to watch and other things like that.
Yeah.
I actually determined that this is the longest period in my entire life that I've gone without leaving my house overnight. And I'm 46 years old.
Yeah.
So that's something to think about. And so the lack of human interaction being in person relates to fundraising too, because of, I want to come back to the emotional connection, because you can do a lot of things through Zoom and through virtual, but the emotional connection might not be there. But I'm going to put a pause there for a second because you asked me what it made me do. And it's really made me think a lot about our profession as fundraisers, as advancement officers, because when you have that much time by yourself, there's not the cacophony of noise that can be in the background, whether it's doing the dishes or creating a new window treatment or even painting things. You know, you're thinking, my mind isn't one that I normally get that much unclouded time. And so, I keep hearing this word since the pandemic, you know, pivot. And I'm so tired of hearing the word pivot, almost as much as I'm tired of hearing the word impact. And I'll get there in a second. As a former dancer, though, I use the example, you know, whether it's a plie or a pirouette, the whole goal of a pivot is to turn and to go somewhere different. And what different directions are we going? And so as I've been thinking about things, you know, with my new appointment for American Library Association, or even in my own role, we had a building project that we were working very hard on for a new construction for a new library. And that's been put on pause. And, you know, so you think about how does this change where things are going? And then I also wonder, well, what's going to happen next? And so you asked me, like, what have I been thinking about? I've been thinking a lot about the Jetsons and how prescient Mrs. Jetson was, that she had a mask that she could put on for her screen every morning when she had her coffee and she didn't have her makeup on. I've thought of my favorite book, which is Edward Bellamy's Looking Backward. He sort of put it out there in the ether about credit cards. So I'm thinking about who those, as a person who likes to think in the future, what the future looks like, and being comfortable in the space of, I don't know, but I know it's going to be different.
We've probably broadcast, I don't know, 24 conversations since the pandemic started. And I don't think we've had a conversation on the podcast about this notion of pivot. Sit on that with me for a moment. So you said you're a dancer and you understand what a pivot is. I think what my hang up, and I think this is kind of what you're saying about your sort of weariness of hearing the term. It seems to me that part of what fundraising needs to recognize is that maybe pivoting isn't what we need to be doing. Maybe we need to be ensuring that those of us who are dancers know how to dance in the first place. Because isn't pivoting for a dancer just simply one of those skills that a really talented dancer knows how to do? Am I right?
Well, a pivot is just moving you is a turn from place to place. So the leap is different. And I think we might be using pivot in a way just like we use impact. You know, impact means to hit something hard. And we talk about impact differently in fundraising. I would rather use other terms in that case as opposed to, well, what's the impact this is going to make? You know, that's to me about the emotional connection that I was just mentioning. You know, is it bringing you back to transformational giving is from an emotional center. It's not transactional. And so one of the key things from a pivot standpoint is we're talking about how does this change our organizations. And we often talk about what giving can do in our organizations and how it moves us forward.
Yeah.
So, you know, to me, this is another thing we were talking about was Hegel's book about, you know, the pull factor or the push factor. This is a push and a pull. You know, we could say we're in a hurricane or a tornado and we don't know where Dorothy's going to land. Okay. You used the Wizard of Oz recently in one of your, but we don't know. We know we're not in Kansas anymore, but we don't know where we're going to end up. And so, but that's where it's okay. So what do you do to prepare for where you land? What skills are you working on in this time? What are you thinking about?
That's what takes me back to the notion of a pivot. I don't want somebody who's a really bad dancer to know how to pivot. I want them to know how to first have learned the fundamentals. I've got a really good friend who's got two daughters that dance in the, I'm going to have to text her after we have this conversation, who dance in the Philadelphia Ballet. And I'm thinking about pivoting and I'm thinking that her daughters are some of the most talented dancers that I've ever seen. And they're like 10 and 12 years old. My kids don't dance. And so, but I'm thinking that she probably, I'm thinking probably in her, in Catherine's sort of playbook as a dancer herself, the mother, the notion of pivoting is probably not all that extraordinary of a concept.
Well, and there's
it's just part of what dancers do. Am I right?
Well, I think this is the thing. You have, if you're dancing on point, you're pivoting differently. It's a different pivot than if you were turning, doing the tango or the cha-cha, the point, or even the shag here in North Carolina. The point is, though, that there's still an axis of 360 degrees. You can only turn in certain ways. If you're jumping, leaping, whatever, you know, you're making it a sphere. But the point is, it's still only a 360-degree, you know, ability to turn. But I think this is where, with the pivot, everybody's not starting in the same place. Every gift officer's portfolio isn't in the same place. Every organization isn't in the same place. Every constituency within an organization isn't in the same place when they started. Now, you drop in COVID on that, okay? What's happening with COVID in, back to Kansas, is very different than maybe in Philadelphia, is very different than here in North Carolina. How it's impacting a budget of a small nonprofit that's an arts organization is probably very different than a large university system. So what it looks like to, and then how it's impacting that gift officer could be very different based on their own circumstances, you know, based on where their portfolio was, what gifts were in the hopper, what their sector is that they're raising money for. So I just think, you know, the whole idea of pivot is it causes change. So instead of saying pivot, I mean, to me, it's change. And, you know, change is a scary word. So we're using pivot instead of change because, like, we could go back to who moved my cheese. You know, people are afraid people are afraid of that. So I think that's the key thing that, you know, and back to your point of everybody needs to know basic steps. Yeah, for a dance, you do. And this is back to, you know, all of those dances didn't exist when we had the last plague. Okay. So, and when I say the last plague, I mean, I'm not going back 100 years to the flu epidemic of 1918.
Spanish flu,
But when you think even about that, the Lindy, it was invented right after that. You know, it caused a new dance to start. So you put that out there. So, like when we're talking about how this could change things, I think if we stick with, are metrics going up or are metrics going down? Or this is it? But what about, is that the really most important thing that we should be measuring as far as how, as gift officers, we're achieving something? I guess I'm going in a different direction on that.
I was on a, here's a thought for you. So I was exchanging text messages with a friend of mine at Auburn yesterday. He manages a team of gift officers down there. Uh-huh. And we were talking about, he's supervising a team of 5 or 6 gift officers at the university. And I was saying to him that some of the metrics that I would expect as a guy who does a lot of coaching with these gift officers, some of the metric I would expect are the ability to sort of, and this gets to that word of pivot. It's that ability to sort of pivot or sort of apply those basic skills that we would generally use, say at a lunch table or over coffee table conversation, be able to demonstrate those skills in a Zoom environment, for example.
Exactly. And it's not the same. You know, if you're presenting in the front of a classroom, making your classroom the size of a Zoom screen, it's not the same. But that's not to say you can't apply those skills. And that's where I think I'm worried about causing what I refer to as metric whiplash. And in my new book, that's one of the things that I've written about, because I feel like when we have new people who come in as supervisors in our organizations, whether at the AVP level or the VP level, you know, you go from let's count visits. Let's count unique visits. Let's count proposals only. Let's count new people qualified. And it causes like what I call metric whiplash, you know, oh, we're going from one extreme to the other. And that's not necessarily helping our potential donors. That's not helping our new gift officers back to learning skills to be able to change on a dime. You know, how are, and I'm back to your conversation with your friend at Auburn. I mean, you know, part of this is giving people permission to fail in trying new things as we're in a Zoom environment or other. And you might have people who have a constituency that their average age is older, and they might not be as comfortable in a Zoom environment, but they're more accessible than somebody who has a younger profile of donor. So maybe phone is best with them. Maybe they want to see stuff in the mail. Other people would say, well, based on this geography, I don't want to receive any mail. So it's being able to micro-target, I think, is going to be, but also that goes back to metrics can't always be one size fits all. And we've tried in this profession to make it that way. And I think that's been a disservice for my unit specific, for library specifically.
I think I'm right there with you. I mean, you and I could not. I think Carlene, what most concerns me about, I have a client out west, and he's a development. The school is a school, but the gentleman that I'm most spending my time with is a development officer, and the last couple of times I've met with them, we've talked about doing online meetings with major donors, and I think what most concerns me is less about the, like, for instance, you describe yourself as an extroverted, you know, fundraiser who likes to be on the road, who has developed an appreciation for, or willingness at least, to be on the road 120 days a year, or whatever you said. Whereas I think for so long, pre-COVID, we've had fundraising professionals hiding behind some of these arm's length, what I consider to be very shallow fundraising tactics, largely, you know, web-based and email and so forth. They weren't having real conversations. They weren't even doing what you and I are doing. You and I are just sort of dancing around on a podcast platform here. We don't know where this conversation's going. You know how to do that with a donor. I think we got a lot of fundraisers out there who've never done that. They didn't do it prior to COVID-19, and they're not going to start doing it now. So pivoting just means doing more of, in my mind, doing more of the same. And now feeling like they have a rationale to do it that way. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And I have a few places I want to go with that, because I had one donor at a former institution, and he told this story, and he still does, about having had an interaction with a different organization where he kept getting asked, you know, he'd ask a question and the gift officer he was working with would say, "That's a good question." And they'd never answer the question and they'd never follow up. And so my response now is, "That's a good question and I need a better answer." And so, you know, are we doing those follow-up things? I think we have the opportunity in this space right now to ask our staff, like, you know, if there was no fear of reprisal, you know, what thing would you like to try? Looking around your organization for the futurist, whether they're the annual fund caller or the senior vice president, you know, what's out there? I think we are hesitant right now to let people try different things. We want to grasp back to the, you know, who stole my cheese. We don't want to rethink or retool. We want to grasp on what we've always known. And some of the basics, yes, that you're talking about, but without all the extraneous, let's measure everything under the sun. You know, good development work is always going to be good development work. But back to your principle with dancing, I don't know that everybody knows what it looks like anymore. because I think we know what it looks like from a transactional sense, but not necessarily the transformational sense that you have a donor in front of you who's crying because you've helped them achieve their dream. I have one
right. Nobody can. Right. Okay. Correct me if I'm wrong, but you can't pivot well if you didn't know how to do, if you didn't know how to dance well to begin with. Am I right?
Right. You have to know some basic steps. And what I think you're saying is we've dropped people in into dancing, pick whatever dance, 4.2 when they didn't get right. the basic steps. And so I hear that. And we also have to know when you have to go back and relearn something. For example, relearning Zoom. When I say relearning Zoom, a lot of people haven't necessarily done teaching on this type of platform. Or if they have, they might have done a lot of web-based teaching in an asynchronous environment or without video feed. You can do it just audio. There's lots of different things like that. But I think we have people who want to hold on and grasp on what we already know. And the future is here. And we need to think about how to embrace and harness the creativity that's coming out as opposed to squelching it. And I think that's something, you know, from a gift officer standpoint, looking at that, you know, constituencies aren't always interchangeable. In case of, well, a consultant saying this works at this institution. Well, have they had a longer time of donor engagement? Do they have a different brand model? Or is this just trying to apply what's worked somewhere else at a different, you know, in a different space? Like I used the example earlier about libraries. Well, in higher ed specifically, over time, people would be promoted out of the library, Jason. They would be promoted out of the library to a bigger constituency. Well, guess yeah. what? That meant that library donors had a constant turnstile. And library is not an easy constituency because in higher ed, we've always said, well, they graduated from this college, so let's put them in that pipeline first. But that's not necessarily accurate. That was for our ease, not for the donor's preference. And then somebody, I've heard too many times, well, but they've given to other units. And my response is, well, were they ever asked for the library? Were they ever asked for the art museum? Were they ever asked for the new Center for Neuroscience that didn't exist when they were a student? You know, those are things that we're not necessarily looking for the innovation at all levels. And I think one of the points on that I've been reading a book, Range, by David Epstein, yeah. and yeah. he and it talks about generalists and specialists. And I'd rather see myself as a specialized generalist or, because I feel like I am able to talk library and I'm able to talk fundraising and I'm able to merge them. But you still have to learn all those components and be fluid throughout them. I like to refer to myself as a chameleon in some ways because I like to be a disruptor of stereotypes. I don't look like the typical librarian and I don't want to. But I think we have in fundraising specifically, we've had this desire of everybody does the job exactly the same, or they're going to, and every donor works exactly the same. And so now it's, well, let's measure how many times it's taken you, Carlene, to get from point A to point B with a donor. And Jason could have done that in 2.1 steps. I feel like we're on the name that tune show from back in the day. You know, well, I can answer the song in this many steps or in this many things. And I feel like we need to look at, but okay, did I come up with a different longer term outcome? Yeah.
Okay, go back to the how many meetings did you said earlier? I want to say it was 120, but I want to make sure I'm using the right numbers. Is that how many nights you said you spent on the road last year or something like that?
Yes, but that wasn't all for work travel. That's how sure. many days because we were just talking about COVID. Yeah.
Okay. So,
but if somebody told, go ahead.
if somebody told me that if a major, I think if somebody picked up the phone right now and they were asking me for some, you know, if they were hiring a development officer, I would say that some of the only development officers that are going to thrive in this space are the same people who were doing those lunch table conversations to the tune of 120 nights on the road, you know, in any 12 months. And they're just going to have the advantage of, or the efficiency that's going to come with being able to do it behind a laptop and do it in Zoom meetings. That underlying skill set is really not going to change. You know, my ability to build meaningful relationships, for example, just starting, you know, having conversations with you here on a podcasting platform is not a whole lot different than the skill set that it requires for you and I to sit down at the local Starbucks and talk about, you know, funding your library campaign. And I think that's what's going to get us in trouble 6 months from now, is that we actually think that there's something new out there, when in fact the talent that we need really is the same talent we needed a year ago.
But we need to treat the talent differently. You know,
I agree with you. I agree with you 110. I couldn't agree with you more. But Carlene, they were not treating them any better a year ago than they're going to treat them now. In fact, they might actually get worse.
Well, and I think that's part of where, you know, I have a dear friend who was supposed to be starting another job, had already left her former position. She's now a single mom with no job because of what's happened during COVID as a fundraiser, and a very gifted one at that. And
yeah,
I look at this space and I wonder, well, if we think that people are interchangeable, you know, I go back to my sports analogy, you know, whether it's a WAR statistic, you know, wins above replacement statistic, you know, there's that intangible that people bring to a space. And there was an article that has gotten some play on LinkedIn from other consultants about business travel and how bankers feel like they're not going to, they're connecting more with less travel, and that this should mean that numbers and metrics should be able to go up during this crisis. But to me, when you're talking about that, you're talking about transactional things. They're not selling they're selling a business model. You know, to switch which major bank you are going to have your accounts with, you know, there's a different relationship. It's not about an emotional connection. And it's giving is something that, you know, impacts, to use the word that the profession uses that drives me a bit crazy, you know, giving turns or motivates the wallet and the heart. It's not the same thing as an investment banker. And so it's about, you know, touching the soul kind of thing. And I think that's one of the key things that you asked me what I'm learning. You know, I'm thinking about resiliency differently. There have been a lot of reaching a donor base that they're not sure what's going to happen next. And how do you connect with them? But I think one of the key things that I feel like, you know, we used to, you've heard the phrase color inside the lines or color outside the lines, but I feel like those lines are getting more distinct based on what you're, you know, this conversation
sure.
as well. And
sure.
I think that's concerning because, you know, as we see today, a quarter of the U.S. workforce has now lost their jobs, you know. Yes. How is that going to impact the marketplace for fundraisers? I'm not sure. But I just, one of the key things that I keep coming back to is those organizations that are going to be more successful allow for more independence than less. And I think it goes
but
back.
But is that going to mean, okay. You're working on a book about metrics. My podcast, I would say that probably 1 out of 10, maybe 1 out of 12 of my guests prior to COVID-19 got on here and metrics came up. I remember one of my earliest guests talked about this culture of metrics, and I have subsequently spoken about metrics at a conference, for example. Are we at the place as fundraisers? So I'm talking to the individual like yourself who's actually doing the fundraising work. Are we at the place now where we can sort of recognize that perhaps it's a seller's market where the sort of the ball's in our court, and we need to insist rather than tolerating some of this mess that we tend to get from supervisors? We need to start being willing to call the shots. And what I mean by that is, and I say this to people when I'm talking to a development officer who's looking for a new job, I give them sort of essentially negotiating points in terms of how they should negotiate their next job. Does a person like yourself who might be going and looking for another job at some point need to actually negotiate the terms when you go to that interview for how you're going to do the work and make sure that that gets put into that job description?
Well, I think one of the things on that, Jason, and I have to say, I work for an exceptional team here at UNC Greensboro.
Sure, sure.
I really do.
Yeah, we're not trying to move you out of your job. Yeah, yeah.
But I actually work for individuals who have talked about this space and who understand the nature of the change in culture over this time. So I want to put that clearly out there. But the issue with the scenario you just set up is I could make that agreement with whoever hires me next, but yeah, in 2 years, the whole team could change. And so whatever, that's what I refer to as metric whiplash. The book that I worked on with Joyce Garzinski is about academic library fundraising, but metrics in there were part of the discussion. But back to your question, so you could put it in your new job description all you want, but that doesn't mean in 18 months to 2 years that those people are in the same seats. And so that's one of the concerns, you know.
So do we need to get better at? Okay. And I get that. But does that also mean, I've got a call tomorrow with a woman who reached out to me. She's in Philadelphia. She's thinking about changing jobs, and she's asking me for probably input along the lines of what we're talking about. But does part of my advice need to be to her something along the lines of what I just suggested, but also something along the lines of being able to more accurately discern whether or not the people you're going to be working for are going to be there in 18 months?
Well, I think that is a question, and that's been a question that I've asked on interviews, et cetera. I think you have the turnover issues we've had in advancement might get worse after this pandemic. That said, I think it goes back to who are you working for? I think when you had Kathy Duff on your series,
he was
talking about this in terms of the ties of the individual to the organization, that the nature of who you're working for and how their ethics, their standards, and I think those are the things that she would want to suss out, not just what the organizational goals are, but what, you know, who are you working for and with?
Here's a question. If you and I were both out there in the job market looking for jobs, and we said, we're going to draw a line in the sand. Carlene and I are both looking for jobs. We're palling around and sort of encouraging each other along in this sort of job search process. What if we both said we're not going to go work for organizations where the supervisor that we're going to work for hasn't been in their seat for more than or less than, say, 2 years?
But I think you've just narrowed your job
field. If we want to raise the standard, it seems to me like if we want to raise this, because I've said it repeatedly with my guest, in fundraising, we've got a supervisor problem. We don't have a fundraising problem. That's essentially what you're getting at. And it seems like we owe it to our collective. It seems like we owe it to our collective community of fundraisers to say we're going to raise the standard on these bosses, because in the midst of this sort of this now virtual world, if we don't, we're going to get metric whiplash because the boss is going to change every 18 months.
Well, and I, I think that's true. I think it's also getting boards to understand that just by saying, let's raise more money, do more proposals, et cetera. I understand more work in leads to more output out. I get that. But if we're not doing the strategy before we're going on visits just so we can hit a number, that's a different problem. And if we're just trying to hit these targets, I mean, and let's be honest, no one is going to come out unscathed or unchanged personally, professionally, or organizationally from COVID. I mean, this is a change agent. And so as far as what that looks like, it could look different for different organizations. And in terms of the hiring process, I'm not sure what it'll mean for what's essential for gift officers. Personally, I would hope that it's more about the care and concern that you show your donors. And I think this has come up, you know, with guests you've had on this visit with large names in this space. You know, I sent an email, Jason, a few weeks ago about an organization in the community that keeps sending me their newsletter. And I was like, okay, now that I'm sitting at home, you know, back to hearing the quiet for too long, it's like, you know, this is something I really want to work on, right? So I sent an email saying, you know, the COVID crisis has really made me think about where I want to spend some of my time. I'd be interested in volunteering. The response I got was, well, right now we're not really accepting volunteers, but thank you for reaching out. That doesn't read like, if that's how they're treating me as a potential volunteer, how are they treating the individuals they're supposedly helping at this point? And maybe it was just somebody having a bad day and that's the response I got. But, you know, you asked a question about you and I talking and, you know, agreeing on certain things. One of the key things that I've been talking with others about and was supposed to speak about at a conference that got canceled was about this idea of candid confidants. And in the academic space, we talk about critical friends, okay? And critical friends being somebody who's willing to critique writing or critique other things. And that has a real specific space in the tenure faculty line. But this candid confidence is very similar. And if you've ever heard of Grenny's, you know, crucial conversations and that sort of thing.
Yeah, totally.
These are people that you surround yourself with who aren't necessarily in your direct line, aren't in your organization, but can provide resources or ideas on what you're talking about. And I have built a network of those for myself. And I think it's helpful when they're intergenerational too. You know, it's not just about what skills do I bring to a gift conversation. It's hearing, oh, you know, have you thought about this space? Have you thought about this virtual event? It's networking up, down, and across. And I think this candid confidence thing is something that when we're talking about building our professional networks, it's not just that I have another person on LinkedIn, another connection on LinkedIn. It's, okay, is there a specific way that we can help each other? And it's not mentoring, because mentoring technically usually only goes one direction. And I think Kathy Duff was talking about this also in your space. And I feel really strongly about that, because I learn just as much from when I'm providing advice than when somebody's providing advice to me, because you have to have that level of trust and authenticity and passion to help that other individual. And when I say help, it's not necessarily, it might just be a listening ear. But isn't that what we're supposed to be doing with donors? Isn't that what we're supposed to be doing with our potential supporters?
I think you're exactly right. But I think that loops back to, we have had so many low context relationships, so many shallow fundraising professionals have been getting away with shallow, low context relationships with their donors for so long. And now you get into a place where you can't even, you get into an environment like this where you can't even take them out to lunch and sort of buy them a nice steak dinner. And so to close that gift, for example, and to have that cultivating and stewarding conversation, you actually have to put some serious energy into it. And that energy may have to sort of be sort of like delivered through Zoom. And so I think we're about to move into a zone where the really talented fundraisers are going to still sit at their desk talking to a donor via Zoom. But there's going to be high demand for them. And I think it's a seller's market. And I don't think pivoting, you know, to kind of pull all this together, I don't think pivoting is really what we're looking for. I think we're looking for that fundamental skill set that says this person knows how to dance and this person knows how to dance with their donors. And
I think it goes back to being nimble. And yes, if you know how to dance one dance, you can learn a different dance in a different location.
Yes, exactly.
But back to the nature of, I feel like we've already taken some of those people out of our space, unless they have wonderful supervisors. Because, you know, oh, well, you weren't meeting your metrics last year because we changed them three times, but you weren't meeting them. But you know what? You've built a good working relationship with these donors, but you know what? You didn't hit all your targets, so therefore you're not a value to the organization. I think those are things that you've heard in this space before. And I think that is something that needs to be rethought back to, you know, all these productivity measures. So, you know, if somebody's measuring, well, it took me 4.8 visits to get to a close and it took you 2.6. So obviously, Jason, you're the winner in that case. That doesn't mean that we built a solid foundation for that relationship. That means you got the gift now. That doesn't mean you built the transformational relationship for the organization. And I guess when you asked me about what I've been thinking about, how do we slice that onion differently? You know, how do we look at that problem differently? How do we, and so those are, you know, as I think about the whole space of COVID, for me, one of the things, even back to libraries and back to what is essential. So I'm going to ask this question. I'll leave it here. And this may be another visitor or maybe a future visit. We could pick this up is what is essential in being a gift officer? What are those basic steps?
Right. Because
as you were saying, it seems like we've not thought about that. And so tying it back to the library, you know, thinking about what does an essential worker mean? Well, what are those essential skills in being a gift officer? How do we position them? Are we lauding them? Are we rewarding those?
Well, and the inherent risk in that question, if employers, I think that's the question that the employer has to answer. Because if we don't, just like the example I offered when we were talking about essential, you know, the essentialness of a library. Mm-hmm. If I represent the quote unquote donor, similar to the way that I've been, I essentially, because I wasn't aware and honestly didn't look into it, but because essentially Amazon, I replaced the library for the last 10 weeks. My library at the college where I teach, I replace the library with Amazon. And so if we don't start thinking critically through this and we don't begin to understand what is essential, and if we keep using buzzwords like pivot to rationalize some of this hypermetrics or something, I think ultimately we're going to diminish the, you know, we're going to, the thing is, you may close that gift, Carlene. You may close that gift in 4.5 meetings. I might close it in 2.5. But I think what's most important is that you and I both derive a lot of joy and pleasure from doing that work to begin with. And that's what I think employers need to learn how to pay for, is you and I both would say that we enjoy those meetings and we enjoy that process. And how expedient that process happens to be is largely not in our control.
Well, and
by you putting up with the notion that a gift can be closed in 2.5 versus 4.5 meetings, in my mind, is you convincing your employer. I wouldn't tolerate that metric, because that metric is not, you can't control that metric. It's the donor that controls that metric. And if the donor doesn't choose to do it in 2.5 or 4.5, I just want to know as your employer that you keep getting back to the lunch table.
Well, and Zoom meeting. Your point, every donor isn't the same. Every person isn't the same.
No, they're not a robot.
But I think we've also created a space in this, in fundraising, where we don't allow for the handoff, Jason. We don't allow for a person to say, you know what, Jason, talking to this person, I think you'd have a better connection with them and be more successful getting a gift, especially in large organizations. That doesn't necessarily apply in smaller ones, but in larger ones, I don't feel like we've allowed for, you know what, I think there'd be a better connection here, or how do we do this best for the long term? And I think one of my key things for this, you asked about joy. We want to have a process where that donor, that individual, feels joyful about what transformational thing they've led occurring. And we're not, and if it's like, oh, well, you made the gift, now on to the next person. That's not helping that relationship, especially when you're measuring things like that. I'm sure, it's like, okay, well, I'm going to measure how long it takes to get to here. And I think this is where, you know, all the assessments in the world don't equal instilling that passion in that donor for why their support for this particular project meets their philanthropic passion. I mean, I think when I like to say that I connect people with ideas and people with people. And I think, you know, that's one of the key things about libraries is that they cause light bulbs to go off for people. They, you know, and if that's what a good gift officer does, it causes a light bulb to go off like, hey, I want to do that. I want to learn more about that. So I feel like that's a change in this space too. But from a COVID standpoint, whether we call it a pirouette or a plié or a pivot or a change agent or whatnot, it still matters of, you know, when we come out the other side, it's going to look different. And are we prepared for that? Are we allowing those people to make those changes to the rules or to the structure? And if we're not, why not? And I think I'd leave our conversation there if that's all right with you.
It's fine. Carlene, if somebody has been listening to our conversation, we went all over the place and I really enjoyed the conversation, and you and I could probably keep each other going for another hour. But if somebody else wants to reach out to you and continue the conversation, how would you suggest that they do that?
They can feel free to reach out to me via my email or via LinkedIn. Love to connect with them. So it would be, my email is knjennings@uncg.edu or via LinkedIn. So thank you.
Yeah. And I will put your LinkedIn profile in the show notes. And it's certainly a pleasure. And you're always welcome back. I do look forward to, at some point, we can meet here and we can meet on Zoom, but I do look forward to buying you coffee at some point. Thanks again.
I look forward to it. Thank you.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must-read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.